Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once again, we're stepping into the centre circle to discuss another wonderful book, obviously football related. And again, we're lucky enough to have the author with us to sort of talk us through the whys and the wherefores and the inspiration and the journey that he went on literally while he was writing this book. But before we get to the most important guest on this podcast, I should introduce the other two. Not that they're any less important, just a bit more regular, that's all. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, you are important, and welcome to the podcast.
I like to think that we're a comfortable piece of furniture, is what we that me and Gary are in these podcasts.
like a pair of comfy armchairs.
Anything like that, anything that's particularly you take comfort out of, then that's good enough for me.
Excellent. Looking forward to this episode.
Oh yes, as ever. But this one's one to look forward to, because it's it kind of like, I'll come to it later on, but it kind of like ticks a little, I don't know, kind of like cul-de-sac doesn't sound the right word here, but there's a certain, only a small amount of books that kind of like tick this box. And when they come along, they are always memorable and just a joy to read.
And the title as well. The title sort of...
Yes,
massively, the titles. You can't help but ignore it as soon as it sort of comes up on...
It is.
It came up on social media feed, you're drawn to it, aren't you?
It is. It's massively, massively eye-catching. And if you're scanning along a bookshelf or you're going through any online retailer, you would immediately like stop and want to know what this book is about.
It's a subject, and I think probably maybe an area, should we say, maybe a geographical area that's probably we've not actually covered that much on the podcast.
I don't remember us doing so at all. Apart from them being involved in World Cup podcasts and stuff like that, way back in the day with Jim when we were doing the World Cup podcasts and 2002 came into view, then obviously that, they were there for that. But I don't ever remember going into kind of like the club branch of this nation at all.
And obviously the second sort of co-host for this, and as like we say, still just as important as Stephen, but arguably still as comfy as well. Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, matey. And if anybody doubts Steve's ability as a purveyor of words, I'm happy to say that I've never been compared to a piece of furniture before and felt it was a compliment. Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, mate. Looking forward to this. As Stevie said, it's a subject we haven't really covered in the past. And it's a fascinating book, and one of those where you just want to keep reading the next page and the next page. So it'd be great to have a discussion with the author.
And I suppose, obviously, as per usual, I'm sure all three of us are going to find out a whole lot more about a subject that we're maybe not quite as aware of. But like I said, Stephen, not so much that we've not covered it a lot, which we haven't, but is it an area that's sort of interested you outside of sort of the main domains of Europe and South America?
I guess it's always been a little bit, a little bit distant, and you don't get much coverage in Europe of this sort of Asian league. And yet, there's the Asian Champions League, and which is a growing competition in importance. And I think it's perhaps something that we should be more and more aware of, because the world's always continually becomes a smaller and smaller place, and especially with Korean football is now making a name in big European leagues. Son, of course, at Tottenham is a classic example. So I think, it's perhaps something we should be more and more aware of. It's something I wasn't very aware of, and I'd heard a couple of the names of the club, but only because players had gone there, so very much in passing. But to get the a deeper understanding of the how it works over there, and more important, perhaps sometimes how it doesn't work over there, was a massive insight.
Yeah, and like I say, as much and as comfy as you two guys are, we probably really should move on to our special guest, and obviously the key guy on this podcast who's going to educate certainly the three of us, and hopefully entertain the listeners and sort of give a little bit of insight, into his book for those who've already bought it and read it, and for those maybe like Stephen said there who've seen it on the shelf and sort of considered it. Hopefully this will convince them. So tonight, what goes on in the South Korean city? The World Cup rolls out of town. And tonight, we're going to discuss with the author of this wonderful book, Who Ate All the Squid? It's a story that takes us through, really a remarkable season following the Busan Icons as they sort of try to carve their way into the heart of their stay-away supporters rattling around in a state-of-the-art mega stadium. It is, like Gary said, it's a wonderful story. It's an area we've not covered much. And it's a book that it just visually grabs your attention, even if it's just the spine on a bookshelf. We're incredibly lucky to have with us on this episode, Mr. Devon Rowcliffe. Devon, welcome.
Thanks very much, Stuart.
I would say happy to be here, but I guess maybe part of it is coercion. Part of it is to discuss the book. But before we get into the big discussion, I guess the same question that we ask everyone, certainly everyone who comes on the center circle, and it's first of all for the listeners, like we say, the ones who've maybe seen it on the bookshelf, who've maybe heard the title, what actually is it that the book's about, and why this particular subject?
Okay, that's a good question. So in 2003, I moved to South Korea as a writer. And I was actually a new football fan at the time. I got into football relatively late, only a few years before that. Canada had won the CONCACAF Gold Cup. That's our continental trophy in the year 2000. And that's what really galvanized my interest in the sport. So moving to South Korea in 2003, it was actually the first time for me that I had lived in a country with a proper footballing culture. You could say that Canada and I suppose the USA has a decent footballing culture now, but 20 years ago, that definitely wasn't the case. So to move to South Korea, where football is a very close number two in terms of the sporting popularity, was a bit of an eye-opener. It was a bit of a mecca for me, I guess you could say. So as a writer there, I noticed immediately that there was no book in the English language about South Korean football. So I thought it was a bit of an opportunity. Around the same time when I was out there, there were two books in particular that really inspired me. They were both following the subgenre of following a club around for a season. And that was by no means new, that subgenre. That goes all the way back to, I suppose, 1972, when Hunter Davis wrote The Glory Game about following Tottenham around. He was a fly on the wall in the Hotspur dressing room. It's a fascinating read. But 30 years on from that, there were a couple of books that really grabbed my attention, both about Italian football. So Tim Parks wrote A Season with Verona, and Joe McGinnis, an American, wrote The Miracle of Castel de Sangro. They came from very different perspectives. Tim Parks' book about Verona was going with the supporters to all of the games, going on those torturous 12-hour, 15-hour away trip buses to the opposite end of the Peninsula Boot on Italy. Whereas Joe McGinnis was very much similar to Hunter Davis, I suppose. He was engrossing himself with the squad, getting to know the team, the movers and shakers with the club. Both of them really inspired me. Both of those two books, I should say, really inspired me in terms of whether we could write or whether there would be an appetite for a book about South Korea. And there seemed to be a growing appetite at the time for English language books about overseas football in countries where English isn't the dominant language. And for those of you who grew up watching Channel 4's Gazzetta Football Italia in the early 1990s, I guess you could say in the late 90s, early 2000, there was almost a literary version of that, where you had all these books coming out about different parts of the world in the English language, football in different parts of the world. And it was a really fascinating time where the world seemed to be getting much, much smaller. And all these, corners of the world that you knew very little of suddenly were coming into focus. So that inspired me to write the book. Additionally, there were actually two books about Japanese football that came out shortly before the 2002 World Cup. So as you mentioned, South Korea was a co-host of the 2002 World Cup along with Japan. And two books had come out about Japanese football. So Jonathan Burchell wrote a book called Ultra Nippon, How Japan Reinvented Football. And that was a fascinating look at the launch of the J-League in terms of how do you create something not quite out of thin air like Major League Soccer, but how do you take an assortment of semi-pro works league clubs, I guess you could call them, that have been around for decades, and how do you shift them into something that's more interesting for the general public? And how do you create essentially a league out of nothing? And in particular, how do you get the entire population whipped up and excited about this league and buying all sorts of random merchandise and $5 stickers and things like that? The country was just going insane for the launch of the J-League. And it's a fascinating look at how that was all concocted. The other book was called by Sebastian Moffat, Japanese Rules, Why the Japanese Needed Football and How They Got It. Moffat's book was about the J-League launch. Burchell's book was more about, it looked at the J-League's launch, but it also looked at, it was similar to my book in terms of following one club for a season. So he followed Shimizu S-Pulse. And there was actually an English manager there at the time, Steve Perryman. But he also looked at the founding of the league and why it was created and how it was created. And they were both fascinating books that were looking at the very start of the J-League and how it was created. So it kind of struck me that there's two books about Japanese football, but no books about South Korean football. So I thought there was an opportunity there to tell a story that hadn't been shared with the English language world. Additionally, there was a post-World Cup boom going on in South Korea. So the World Cup they co-hosted was in 2002. I arrived less than 1 year later in early 2003, and the country was still going absolutely crazy for football, particularly the national team. As we'll get into in a bit more detail, there was a temporary boom in club football, but people were just going crazy for the national team. All the players had become celebrities. Gus Hiddink, who would later become a Chelsea manager, Australia and a Russian manager, he was basically promoted to demigod status for a while. So it was a very interesting time to be there watching the football. And in particular, 2003 marked the first occasion that there was a British manager in the K-League. So Ian Porterfield had gone out there and he agreed to take over Busan, a club that had been big but began to struggle. And he actually brought out three players from English football with him. And so I was really interested in how would these Brits fare, both as a manager and as players? How would they do overseas? Because Brits don't tend to travel very often in terms of football. So I'll just run through them really quickly, the four individuals. So Ian Porterfield, as I mentioned, he was brought out as the manager. So he became quite famous for scoring the only goal in the 1973 FA Cup final for Sunderland. So he spent about a decade with Sunderland. He was a big, kind of meaty midfielder, kind of a bulldozer sort of a player. But he happened to score the only goal in that FA Cup final in 73. So Sunderland was a second division side. And in fact, they spent the first half of that 1972-73 season really struggling, trying to stay out of the relegation zone. But they turned things around and ended up winning that FA Cup. Their opponent was Leeds United, who were huge at the time. They were up near the top of the top flight. They were playing in Europe at the time. Don Revie was their manager. He went on to become an England manager, Don Revie. So they were Leeds were a very big side. Even way back then, almost 50 years ago, people thought the idea of a second division team winning the FA Cup had been, you know, condemned to history. That was no longer feasible. It's an unmanageable, you know, fairy tale. It couldn't be done again, but somehow they did it. And as I said, Porterfield was the only one who scored. That was the second time Sunderland's won the FA Cup. They haven't won it since then. And in fact, that's the last major trophy Sunderland has won almost a half a century ago. So Porterfield, even beyond his death, remains a cult figure in Wearside football. So he went out as a manager. He brought over three players with him from English football. So the first one was Jamie Cureton. So Cureton, who's actually still playing, believe it or not, he turned 45, I believe, in August, September. He started out as a academy player for Norwich. Alex Ferguson was putting together the class of 92 for Manchester United's academy. So that included Beckham, Giggs, Scholes, Neville Brothers, Nicky Butt, etc. And Ferguson wanted a traditional number 10, a poaching striker. So he contacted Jamie Cureton, who was setting the Norwich Academy alight, scoring for fun, basically. And believe it or not, Cureton turned Ferguson down and did not want to play at Manchester United, even though, oddly enough, Cureton was personally a Manchester United supporter. So he had already been at Norwich for a few years. He was quite comfortable there. But I think if you look at the context, it made sense, at least very briefly at the time, because Norwich City was a big club in the Premier League back then. I think they were in third place. They were gunning for the Premier League title. You know, before then, they weren't a big club. After then, not really a big club. But at that time, they were a particularly strong side, Norwich were. And they were also playing in the UEFA Cup. So they had opponents like Bayern Munich and Inter Milan, or AC, Inter Milan. So it wasn't, at the time, at least for a 2 or 3 year period, playing for Norwich instead of Manchester United might not have seemed like a strange decision. But perhaps it was a bit of a mistake in the end. And oddly enough, that class of 92 that Alex Ferguson put together never really did have a dominant number 10 striker. And perhaps Jamie Cureton should have been that striker. But he went on to debut in the Premier League for Norwich City. He'd be there for a few years, then he'd go to Bristol Rovers, almost get them promoted, and then he'd go on to Reading, and he scored a famous goal for Reading, in which he got them promoted from the third division to the second division, scoring late away to Brentford on the last day of the season. So he's a big hero for Reading fans. So he was the first player Ian Porterfield brought out, Jamie Cureton. The second was Andy Cook. So he's almost the polar opposite. So instead of being groomed in a Premier League academy, he started out playing semi-pro in Wales. And Andy Cook had to toil building cow sheds in rural Wales in order to be able to afford to play semi-pro football. So not the pampered background that Cureton had. But he was a very good player, scored a lot of goals. He's a very big, kind of barrel-chested player. But despite that, he scored constantly. So he was spotted by Burnley, and that was his first professional contract. I think Burnley converted him from a goal scorer to more of a target man or a target player. And then Stoke City came in early in Stoke's Icelandic revolution. They spotted Cook as a very good target man, this big, strong guy who could provide to their smaller poaching striker. So they brought him in, and actually it was a dream move for Cook because Stoke City was his boyhood club. And so they did well, and he, much like Jamie Cureton, Andy Cook helped Stoke get promoted from the third division to the second division, again during that early Icelandic revolution at the club. And the third player, make sure I pronounce this correctly, was a Norwegian defender, Jon Olav Hjelde. So Hjelde was playing in Rosenborg, which is the biggest club in Norway. But despite being the biggest club, Norwegian clubs don't do very well usually in the UEFA Champions League. But the particular cohort at Rosenborg around that time, they had heroics, I guess you could say, in the Champions League. They knocked out AC Milan at the San Siro. And then in the next round, they drew against Juventus, at least in the first leg, and then ended up getting knocked out. But for this Norwegian club to not only beat AC Milan, but knock them out of the Champions League and then hold their own against Juventus for that first leg, they were known as the heroes of Milan. And a lot of clubs were watching that game, clubs around the world, and they were scouting players from that Rosenborg team. Italian club Bari came in for Hjelde, but in the end, Nottingham Forest signed him, and Hjelde helped Forest get promoted to the Premier League, albeit only for 1 year. So those were the three players that Ian Porterfield brought over to South Korea. And I was fascinated by this. There had been one British footballer out in Korea very briefly who only played, I think, 5 games. So this was a real gamble. This is almost like an attempt at a British revolution out in South Korea. And it was at a club that had historically been strong but had lagged in recent years. So I was really interested to see how they would do. But also I wanted to paint the broader picture of South Korean club football and the South Korean national team and whatnot. So it sounded like a good opportunity for me, as I was just coincidentally living in that same city in Busan as the team that all these British footballers had gone out to join the club for. So it kind of fell in my lap, I guess you could say. I was interested in football. Still, as I said, I had rose-tinted goggles about the sport. I was new to living in a country where football was big, and all this was unfolding. So it just seemed like destiny, I guess you could say. So I decided to write the tale, and it took many years to finally get it published, but here we are today.
Brilliant. It's, you know, hopefully, like I said, people who are listening to that will, you know, like I say, if you've seen the cover and you've seen the spine, hopefully that sort of convince them. Stephen, I'll come to you first. I have got a brilliant question for you at the end of this podcast, you and Gary. But anyway, to begin with, though, it kind of, you know, listening to Devon talk there, we talk about this a lot, but football sort of throws up stories in the most unlikely of places. And it doesn't have to be in the sort of traditional Europe and South America sort of hotbeds of football to throw up the interesting, you know, interesting stories that football can create.
Oh, it does. It does. And I think it's kind of like the growth of the sport in places that are away from the traditional homes of football almost. You know, we tend to say it's our game, it's Europe's game, and we will fully accept South America as having a large stake in the sport. But then away from that for many, many years, football away from Europe and South America was somewhat frowned at. You know, the people, the nations and various parts of the world would be seen as kind of like visitors encroaching on our sport almost. And I think that much of that has been swept away by so much that has happened since that 2002 World Cup. And yes, you know, football has that wonderful way, and we've said before, of breaking the boundaries and leveling the playing field somewhat. And it comes down to that passion and that love for the sport. And, you know, it strips away kind of adulthood and suddenly you're a child again, because, you know, it's something that you take through your life into adulthood. From your childhood, you know, you'll drop the kite and the bottle rocket, you know, and all of those stuff that you've done as a kid, you know, hide and seek, you know, you start playing that. But football, no, you know, and given half the chance, if you see something that's spherical in shape and it's on the floor, then, you know, the temptation to kick it is incredible. So yes, you know, it's always brilliant to see these stories and instances of it, you know, just absolutely everywhere. You know, it is the global sport when push comes to shove.
And I guess, Gary, as well, you know, sort of following on from that question there and what Stephen was just saying there, you know, when, not saying writing a book, but coming up for ideas for books, you know, can be quite difficult. Sometimes it can be really easy, sometimes it can be really difficult. But this is one of those examples where just sometimes an opportunity will present itself, and it's more a question of not so much being brave, but not ignoring that opportunity, and sort of, I suppose the bravery comes in thinking that story is one that somebody, you know, that people are going to want to read and that people are going to be interested in, and almost having the courage of your convictions to go and, you know, go and tell that story. You know, as Dev was saying there, very few books in the English language on Asian football, so in Japan and South Korea. So, you know, that's where, I suppose, where the, you know, Devon's bravery to me comes in that, you know, here's a story, right, you know, he's there right at the beginning. It's almost a too good an opportunity to miss, but often people can spend so much time questioning or doubt as to whether it would hold anybody's interest that opportunity then disappears.
Yeah, it's a good point. I guess, you know, if you're, I mean, we're all sort of fortunate to have had books published, and I don't think either the three of us have sort of reached too far out of our comfort zone, shall we say, of football that we know. And, you know, what Devon did, you know, aside from the fact he went to live in Korea for a while, it's an island type of football compared to what he was used to in Canada, and to sort of write a book about it where so much is different is, you know, as you say, a massive decision. I mean, even, you know, something I wasn't aware of is, you know, the structure of club ownership, for example. You know, they're owned by these massive corporations rather than individuals or sort of business partners and such like. So yeah, I think it was a massively brave decision, and certainly, although Devon was there, it was a massive leap of faith to do that and to sort of become intrinsically involved in a culture of football that was alien to him previously.
It is, and I suppose it's quite a good point. Oh, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right, sorry. Yeah, I suppose it was a good point, actually, that I was just about to ask you there, Devon. Obviously, you know, you say, you know, obviously, you know, Canadian by birth, and, you know, and it's not, you know, it's not Canada's sort of, you know, primary sport. So I guess, as you were saying, they're going to South Korea, where football is perhaps more populous, you know, than it was in Canada. Could you sort of look at the game once you're out in South Korea? You know, certainly I look at it, and, you know, and Stephen sort of mentioned it there about the cynicism of European football and South American football being the two leading continents, and that's it. Whereas obviously to yourself, as, you know, as a Canadian or North American going into Asian football, were you able to look at the game with a sort of far more neutral eyes, I suppose, for want of a better word, and just sort of open to seeing what you saw rather than having almost preconceived ideas?
Yeah, I think so. I had been a bit, I guess you could say, tainted having watched English football for a few years. But yeah, because Canada didn't really have much of a footballing culture, I went in with wide eyes. Oddly enough, the number one participatory sport in Canada in terms of what you play actually is football. But in terms of it being a spectator sport that you go to a stadium, that you go to a ground and watch, it had been, especially then, quite small. So yeah, I guess you could say I went there with fresh big eyes to take everything in. I had been watching English football for quite a few years on television, but obviously going into the stadium, traveling with the supporters on the coach, getting involved in the sing songs and the chants is obviously very, you know, you have to be there to experience that, really, to have that full experience. So yeah, for me, it was fascinating. I took so much in. I knew from reading and watching, at least on television, British football, I knew that there were a lot of aspects of the Korean game and the Korean supporter culture that were very much unique to Korea. So I figured that out pretty quickly. But it was fascinating to go there and see how this country on the opposite side of the world decided to essentially take something from not necessarily the UK, but from the rest of the world and make it their own, shape it in their own way.
Well, it's funny, because I mean, that the question that I just asked you was one that just sort of popped in. The question I was originally going to ask you was, you know, really just sort of a bit of background, you know, Gary mentioned, you know, the sort of the difference in club ownership in South Korea. And I suppose, again, for even for myself, for the listeners, you know, just a little bit of background on South Korean football, the structure of it, certainly at sort of the highest level.
Okay, yeah. So the K-League is actually the oldest professional football league in Asia, but it's fairly young on a world level. It was started in 1983. We know South Korea now is a democracy, but back then South Korea was actually a dictatorship. Early on, after the Korean War, early on, South Korea was a democracy, but there was a military coup. So for about 2+ decades, there was a dictatorship. Democratization protests gained a lot of steam in the late 70s and early 80s. So it really made the regime nervous. So they plotted all sorts of ideas they could use that didn't involve bloodshed to essentially distract people who are interested in democracy, particularly young males around university age. So they came up with this idea called the 3S policy, which was sports, screens, and sex, basically just to distract young men. So the first S in the 3S policy was sport. So in 1982, they launched a professional baseball league. And then the following year, in 1983, they launched a football league. In terms of screens and sex, basically they tried to make television and movies as risque as possible to get young men more interested in that than protesting for democracy. But the baseball league started in 82 and the football league started in 83 were both quite popular. And a few years later, because of the Olympics coming up in 88, the dictatorship eventually fell. But the football league continued on. And long before, I guess in the 60s, when the dictatorship came in, they had a command economy where the military regime would give all sorts of favors to a select number of companies, and they grew absolutely massive. So you've heard of companies that called the Zaibatsu in Japan, like Sony. Korea has its version of the Zaibatsu, known as the Chaebol. So you've heard of some of these names like Samsung and Hyundai. So these are these absolutely massive business conglomerates that have their finger in dozens, if not hundreds, of economic pies, and they make up such a big chunk of the South Korean GDP. So when the regime asked for these pro sports leagues to be started, it was essentially the responsibility of these very wealthy business conglomerates to start the clubs and essentially bankroll the clubs. So when the league started out, the K-League, it was actually known as the Super League at the time when it was founded in 83. But when it was started out, the majority of the clubs were owned and bankrolled by these massive corporations. And that's still the same thing today, still the same way today. If you look at the top flight of the K-League, most of the clubs are owned by these large corporations. So the last few years, the big two teams, it's Jeonbuk Hyundai Motors and Ulsan Hyundai. So essentially, these are two different subsidiaries of the Hyundai Corporation or conglomerate that are bankrolled. And a lot of these teams are bankrolled like that, like Samsung. You might know Samsung from your cell phone or so your mobile phone. Yeah. They bankrolled the Suwon Blue Wings Club, which started out in the late 90s. They were kind of this nouveau riche club that actually Busan hated. That's a story for another time. There have been some clubs that have used what's called a citizen club model. So one model is this huge corporation funds you. The other is that essentially local government, either your city council or maybe your provincial council will fund the club. And those clubs tend to be a lot smaller in terms of budget and the financial clout, so they can't really compete quite as well as the big corporate clubs. But it still is essentially that same way today, that all clubs are either corporate owned or local government owned.
It's fascinating, and it's part of the reason why, you know, the book is so fascinating as well. But I guess I'm going to come to you first on this one, Gary, because it doesn't seem to matter where in the world we're talking about football, which guest we have, what the subject is. At some point, somewhere, politics will have been involved.
Yeah, isn't that true, man? Isn't that true? Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, there was another club that I didn't mention, but that's the Army, or the Armed Forces Club, that apparently players can get, when they have to do national service in Korea, they can choose, it's not the right word, but get selected to play for the Army or the military football club, and they don't have to go and do the sort of, you know, square bashing that the normal recruits have to do. And it's a fascinating part of the book to read about this culture. And you say the politics, as you say, is sort of very important in the development of football in Korea. As Devon mentioned about the dictatorship that sort of wanted to use football. Now they say that religion's the opium of the masses. Well, they were looking at sport to be the opium of the masses, weren't they? And also beyond that, as you say, in recent times, where, you know, local councils get involved or provincial councils get involved in these citizen clubs. It just seems so alien to people used to British football, and just shows how the development of the game in South Korea is so different. And perhaps that's because it's fairly young and it grew up in the environment that it had. Whereas we're talking about the British game, obviously grew up in an environment that's 150 years old now.
you can tell how long we've been working together. My next question for Stephen was, do you think that maybe that's why the sort of that, not suspicion is probably the wrong word, but it's something that's almost in, you know, the development of clubs, this sort of corporate nature of the development of clubs is something that to us seems so alien, although you look now at club ownership and it's completely different. But, you know, if you look at the sort of origins of the game, as Gary mentioned there, yes, it's 150 years ago, but do you think that that's why, you know, sort of English fans maybe perhaps, or stereotypically some fans struggle to sort of relate to Asian football because of its almost synthetic nature in the way that it's been developed?
Right, yeah. Yeah, probably. I think anyone who comes from a country that has football as a long since created tradition, you know, and we're going back hundreds of years in this country, then, you know, we blanch even when kind of like stuff like squad numbers coming in, you know, back in the 90s and stuff like that. Anything that breaks from tradition. I think it's anything that breaks. We always go back to that concept of being hardwired to football and how impressionable you were at a point of genesis when you become fully, I don't know, welded to football as such. And everything from around that point in time becomes sacrosanct and sacred. So anything that kind of like veers from that is seen as being, you know, wrong. It's not the right way to do it. So, you know, even to the point that, you know, for me, First Division should still be populated by the likes of Coventry City. And they're not going to be, probably. But, you know, this is where it comes from, I think, is that, you know, there's a certain set way that people think things should be. And the fact that it isn't, because I think it even has a knock-on effect down to the non-league system in the UK. The way that teams will merge with one another, you know, Dagenham and Redbridge were one, weren't they? Rushden and Diamonds, they both made it to the Football League, having been separate clubs. And there's something slightly uneasy. It's the fact that, you know, even to this day, and the fact that AFC Wimbledon are headed, you know, have gone back to Plough Lane now, you know, MK Dons will always be branded in a certain manner. So anything that is seen as kind of a break from that tradition as we believe football should be is always met with pitchforks and flaming torches. You know, expand the World Cup, it's not right. Expand the European Championships, it's not right. You know, change, anything to do with change with football fans is never taken very well. But at the same time, if you strip that away and actually go and have a look at these things, and you know, the massive eye openers. You know, I was lucky enough to go to Japan, and you know, I got a really close up look of at a club that were only in operation for I think less than 10 years when I was there, Nagasaki, Viva in Nagasaki. And they were winning promotion to the top flight of the J-League from the second division for the first time in their history. And the passion of the supporters wasn't synthetic. You know, whether you thought the club was or not, there was that love and that affection and that connection between the supporters and that club was massively real. You know, and I was lucky enough to gate crash like the biggest day in their history. They won promotion that day. And it isn't, you know, you've got to kind of like detach that old stereotype and just take it for what it is. And, you know, why should it feel any different for the support of a football club that's not long existed? You know, from what I've seen of such a circumstance, you know, it changed my preconceptions anyway.
I absolutely agree. You know, I always think there's a certain level of ignorance where you make a decision without actually looking at it. You know, like you say, you know, there might be initial suspicion or scepticism, or it may not sit okay. But if you've not been to look, if you've not experienced it, you've not investigated it, really, you know, that sort of opinion really is invalid, and you know, until you've looked at it. Like I said, Devin, it's, you know, you can tell it's a subject we don't talk about much, or an area that we don't talk about much. You know, we're all sort of aware that, you know, South Korea co-hosted the World Cup in 2002 with Japan. You know, as you mentioned, you know, you sort of arrived in South Korea just after that. You know, it was the first World Cup in, you know, that was away from the continent of either Europe or South America. You know, it had games that were played indoors. You know, it was very sort of, again, you know, as Steve and I were just saying there, it was very revolutionary. That's not how World Cup sort of tournaments, how World Cup games are supposed to be played. However, once you watch the tournament, and certainly as you go back and watch it now myself, I sort of see it with a bit more, you know, certainly with a lot more affinity than I did at the time. But in terms of South Korea, sort of when you arrived there and the impact, you know, and you mentioned that there was that initial boom, and you know, the players, the South Korean national players, you know, were sort of legends, you know, within their own country. You know, you talk about Gus Hiddink and his sort of status there. But how did that sort of permeate through the whole country and through the entire game? You know, did it go all the way down to grassroots level, you know, if you like? Did it permeate its way to sort of the younger generation?
Yeah, that's a good question. The younger generation definitely were inspired by the World Cup. Particularly South Korea beating four different European countries and drawing against the USA. Arguably, it was the draw against the USA at the beginning in the group stage that really galvanized people. And South Korea really sort of puffed out its chest. And yeah, the young generation in particular that didn't always really like baseball. It's the most popular sport, but it does have a kind of an air of an older gentleman's game, kind of like how cricket might have in the UK. So yeah, it definitely did become very, very popular. In terms of the impact of football domestically after the World Cup, it became the number one sport. I think traditionally, and probably even today, baseball is narrowly ahead as the number one sport. And football has always been a very close number two. But for quite a few years there, football, I would say, was way out in front of baseball in terms of being the most popular sport in South Korea. And as I said, there was that mentality that South Korea, both in terms of football and otherwise, could really compete with the world's best. South Korea had been to four World Cups previous to the 2002 World Cup that they co-hosted. Unfortunately, they hadn't won a single game in those four World Cups, and they usually finished bottom of their group in the group stage. Whereas this World Cup, not only was it their first win, but they actually won their group undefeated. They beat Poland, they beat Portugal, and they also drew against the United States. South Korea has a real love-hate relationship with the United States from its very beginning as a country after the Korean War and the division of the Korean Peninsula. South Korea has been very closely aligned with the United States, and some people see it as a very clear ally, whereas others see it in kind of a negative way, like they're involved in an imperialist sort of way, much like how the Soviet Union was seen to be involved with North Korea, and I suppose China as well. So for a lot of people, it was a real boost of nationalism, and they felt they could beat anyone, really. I mean, they went on to also beat Italy and Spain and went all the way to the semifinals. as you mentioned, it was the first time the World Cup had been hosted outside of Europe and the Americas, but this was also the first time that a country outside of Europe and the Americas had advanced all the way to the semifinals. So it was quite surprising. I mentioned about footballers becoming celebrities. There was one in particular, this young fellow named Kim Nam-il. He became an absolute icon in the country. And he wasn't particularly good looking like a lot of these pop idols are. But interestingly enough, I think it was right time, right place for him. He was very cheeky, I guess you could say. And South Korea has a fairly formal Confucian sort of society where you give respect to your elders and you expect them to be benevolent to you as a youngster, that sort of relationship. And there was a funny story where Goose Hiddink went in and he noticed that in South Korea, the younger players almost felt compelled to pass the ball, to give possession to the older players, even if the younger players were on form and the older players were out of form. Just because of that Confucian nature, the younger players felt they had to give the ball to the older players. And Goose Hiddink noticed this. So he decided to very subtly overrule this, even though it was a kind of a traditional Korean cultural thing. And he said, this doesn't really belong in football. And so everyone should be equal. And he asked all the players to address themselves or address each other as if they were of equal age. So it was quite uncomfortable because some of the senior players were a good dozen years older than, you know, the younger players, but they all had to use the informal version of the Korean language to address each other. So one of the younger players quite cheekily immediately turned to the second oldest player when they were about to start eating lunch. And it was quite an uncomfortable situation because Hiddink had just spelled this out and said, you all have to be equal. And everyone was quiet and the younger players were nervous and the older players might have felt a bit cut down because of this. But this one younger player named Kim Nam-il just shouted out, hey, Myungbo, let's eat, in this very informal Korean language, and had the whole team just burst out laughing. And he became this huge icon because he was, as I said, very cheeky. He didn't really necessarily give the Confucian order as much respect as it deserved. He was very kind of bold and brash. And Korean society was looking for something like that at the time. So he became an absolute heartthrob with the women, despite that he wasn't, you know, particularly good looking. And women would turn up to games with camcorders just to film him. They would have these signs that they would handwrite that would say things like, hey, Nam-il, turn out the lights, and hey, Nam-il, let's only have three children, and things like that. So it was quite a cultural change in South Korea. But I'm talking about the football specifically. Yes, a lot of the players did become absolute huge icons. And it also allowed a lot of the footballers in South Korea to travel abroad. I think a couple of the players had been playing in Europe, but because of the result of the national team doing so well, quite a few players ventured abroad. Goose Hiddink left Korea right after the World Cup. He had a set contract and he intended to go back to club football in the Netherlands. So he brought quite a few players out with him. So Park Ji-sung, who would eventually go on to play at Man United, and Lee Young-pyo, who would go on to play at Tottenham, they both went out to PSV Eindhoven initially after the World Cup. So quite a few of the players went abroad, and that really just galvanized their stature in South Korean society as these icons. And there was a brief boom for the K-League. It didn't last very long. So the K-League is a summer-based league rather than a winter-based league like you have in the UK. So it starts in March and ends in November usually. But because the World Cup started in the summer, they decided to postpone the start of the 2002 K-League until after the World Cup to give Korea a bit of a cheeky advantage, I guess you could say, that most of the squad members did play domestically. So instead of playing in the K-League, they were just basically in a national team camp for a good half of the year. So when the K-League did start up immediately after the World Cup, it was just packed. All the stadiums were just completely full. Tens of thousands of people were turned away at the gates, that sort of thing. Unfortunately, it didn't last that long. I think people figured out that most of the better players had gone abroad. And I think the real mania involved with following the national team was the nationalism or the patriotism, that it was a real coming out party for South Korea, that they could stand up to these, you know, Western powers, often these imperialist powers. And South Korea had a really rocky history. We can talk about that if you like. And this was a real ego boost for the country. So the fact that when you go and you watch domestic league, that nationalist aspect wasn't involved, I think it kind of died out relatively quickly, sadly. But there was definitely a boom there for a good a half a year, maybe three quarters of a year. And also in terms of continuing this thread of the impact on football in South Korea of the World Cup. FIFA asked each of the two co-hosts, so Japan and South Korea, to each build 5 stadiums for a total of 10. Now, South Korea and Japan are rivals in many, many, many ways. And this goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years. So they were each asked to build 5 stadiums each. But because South Korea and Japan were both, they had this rivalry, they just wanted to better each other, that they both built 10 stadiums. So there was a total of 20 stadiums. Now, I think to be fair to Japan, they renovated some existing stadiums, but I believe all 10 of South Korea's stadiums were brand new. So they had this absolute glut of stadiums after the World Cup in South Korea, and they had a fairly small league. I think they only had about 10 teams, I believe, in 2002. So there's all these new World Cup stadiums. So they had to create clubs to fill the stadiums, basically. So there was quite a few clubs established in the years after the World Cup. Unfortunately, back then, FIFA expected countries to build these massive stadiums. And South Korea did that. They were way too big for the need of the K-League for domestic football. So sadly, today, just less than 20 years later, the majority of those stadiums are no longer being used. There was also some kind of strange domestic politics going on. You mentioned politics with Gary. There was a strange law in South Korea that said by default, all stadiums must be multi-use. So they must have a running track. And there were some stadiums built that were football specific without a running track, but the majority had a running track. And that compounded the problem of the stadiums being too large, the capacity is too big. A lot of them have a running track, so there's not a lot of atmosphere. So while it was a big boom for the country, and while it was a great opportunity for the country to show off internationally, the legacy of the stadiums was, well, these stadiums are nice and they're fancy and they have all sorts of bells and whistles, but they're just way too big. And in particular, Busan, the club that my book follows for a season, they were just absolutely dying in this gargantuan stadium. So those are some of the impacts on football in South Korea. In terms of some of the cultural impacts, I already mentioned there was a big swell of patriotism. So as I touched on, the history of South Korea is Korea, I guess you could say, as a united peninsula, is very turbulent politically. If you look at its location on a map, it's right between China and Japan. And those two countries have been big superpowers going back thousands of years. So constantly, South Korea, because of where it was conveniently located, they would become the victims of conquest of either China or Japan. So for example, if Japan wanted to invade China, they would use South Korea as a stepping stone. They'd quietly go into South Korea, refuel, let their soldiers take a break, and then go on to China. So Korea was just constantly being invaded and attacked by its neighbors. And then, of course, it was colonized by Japan in the late 1800s, and it was eventually freed from Japanese colonization once Japan lost the Second World War. But then, of course, the Korean Peninsula was split in two, and there was two countries created, South Korea and North Korea. And the war was just horrendous in terms of death tolls and whatnot. There have been relatively stable decades after the Korean War, but as I mentioned, there was dictatorship. And then finally, you get a democracy, but then as everything's starting to look nice in the late 1990s, you have the Asian financial crisis, which absolutely battered South Korea. So you've probably heard of Hyundai and what's the other one? Samsung. So Hyundai is the largest business conglomerate in South Korea. The second largest one was known as Daewoo. They owned and bankrolled Busan Icon. So they went bankrupt, just overnight gone. There was a lot of dodgy accounting going on. The CEO basically went abroad in the dark of the night to escape imprisonment, that sort of thing. The South Korean economy was battered, but it hit Busan particularly hard because its football club had an existential threat of, we no longer have a corporation bankrolling us. So it was a very turbulent time in South Korea in the late 90s. And I suppose even in the early 2000s, you still felt the economic crisis. So for South Korea to co-host this World Cup, not only to host it, but to beat 4 European countries and to draw against the USA and to be the first country outside of Europe and the Americas to go to the semifinals, it was just this massive celebration and vindication for the country. So arguably, it was a lot more about nationalism and patriotism than it was about the football for the average person. But culturally, it was a huge moment in South Korean history. In terms of how the World Cup impacted football globally, I guess you could say in many ways it broke that mold of Europe and the Americas, that the World Cup really became a World Cup. that you have an Asian country hosting and going all the way to the semifinals. And I think there was a recognition also from people watching on television that when they saw the South Korean supporters, they were very organized. They were very loud. They were singing. The chants were echoing across the stadiums. People didn't expect that. People thought there'd be mostly a typical crowd where you just chant whenever and it would be fairly quiet. But people were really surprised by the voraciousness, I guess you could say, of the supporters. And it turned a lot of heads in the global footballing community. And I think this is really the World Cup where FIFA begins to realize that asking countries to build massive stadiums, these big white elephants, is not working out quite so well. I think it was after the South Africa World Cup where they said, okay, no more. You can build stadiums that can be deconstructed afterwards. But I think this World Cup was the first one where there was a realization that this legacy wasn't necessarily for the best for football, that the countries were pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into facilities and infrastructure, but it wasn't necessarily what the countries needed, especially countries that aren't seen as being a typical traditional footballing country. You want to host the World Cup, you want to increase the popularity of football, and you want that then to galvanize the league and have people come out and support domestic club football. But with South Korea, it kind of suffered because the stadiums were so big. And I think that's where Sepp Blatter finally clued in that, okay, we need to be a little bit more realistic here. And lastly, how the World Cup impacted culturally, I guess globally. In terms of South Korea, their big first international coming out party would be the 1988 Seoul Summer Olympics. That really helped not just to get the country's name out, but by hosting that, it's actually what allowed South Korea to topple its dictatorship and to have a democracy, because the dictators were in power and there was all these political shenanigans going on. And eventually the dictators had to concede, okay, we'll have a free and fair election for president. So that event helped in many ways for South Korea. But this 2002 World Cup, I guess you could say, was their second big global coming out party. K-pop wouldn't become popular in the West until maybe 2010, but I think this World Cup really helped Korea become popular elsewhere in Asia, in China and in even Japan and Southeast Asia in particular. So things like television dramas were being taken up by channels in other Asian countries a lot after this, even in places like India. It would take a while longer to get to the West, but this event really helped South Korea puff out its chest, not just in terms of football, but also in terms of its culture. Now you have this term, the Korean wave of Korean culture going abroad. And this was a major, major event in spreading that Korean wave across Asia.
I mean, it's fascinating. Like I say, it's absolutely fascinating. I think this is why, this is one of the reasons why, we were sort of desperate to get you, to get you on the podcast and chat about this and give us a real insight. And I mean, Gary, there's probably a million and one questions I can ask you guys, just from that. But to me, as we know, legacy is something that fascinates me, whether it's players' legacy, the legacy of a manager, a side, a ton, whatever it is. And sort of Devin touched on it there, and that's the sort of moral responsibility that a World Cup tournament brings. Now, I suppose my question, I haven't quite worked out how to frame it to you yet, but it's, Devin mentioned there about, FIFA sort of finally cottoning on that actually we're asking too much, or, there needs to be some sort of accountability for organising committees to make sure that post-World Cup, the game is sustainable, the venues are sustainable. I mean, we've still seen it in Brazil, with stadiums that were built there. I'm not convinced FIFA have got it right yet. But, in terms of a World Cup, and, we'll use sort of South Korea as the example, as Devin mentioned there, you have this sort of 6-9 month, almost 12-month boom that comes after it, but ultimately you still end up with teams rattling around, in these massive sort of cavernous stadiums. And, at mega events or, certainly at World Cup where there's multiple sites, where does the sort of moral sustainable responsibility lie in terms of a sustainable legacy post event?
Without sort of risking getting sued, I don't think FIFA would talk me across about that sort of thing personally. But you mentioned Brazil, the stadium in Manaus where England, yeah. I think, is used as a coach park now, where the pitch is used as a coach park. It's interesting, in Devon's say about, I remember reading this part in the book about the Korean local Laura Bedge multi-purpose stadiums, and I guess looking to leave a legacy that a growing club structure could pick up. You almost couldn't have a worse scenario than FIFA saying build these mega stadiums and the local law saying you got to have a ring track around them as well. And I guess, you know, and it different paints these pictures of the games in Korea, not only in Busan but in other places as well, in the away games, of it's almost like you're watching football on TV now. The stadiums are almost empty, and you know, without the, you know, the canned crowd noise that some of the TV channels put on for games, you can hear the players shouting, you can hear the coaches shouting, you hear the thud of the ball being kicked, and you know, as I say, Devon paints this wonderful picture of that sort of thing in Korea. And I think Korea were a sort of Korean football, Korean club football was a victim of FIFA's grandiose ideas, and the how that sort of combined with the Korean government requirement to make the multi-purpose stadiums. Perhaps I was being a bit unkind to FIFA at the start for this answer. I'm not sure I was, but perhaps I was. FIFA, people say about, you know, FIFA's purpose is to look after football, and other people say, no, FIFA's purpose is to make money, look after football, just how they do it. I take on board what Devon was saying, that, you know, there was a sort of movement to accept that, you know, Korea and Japan was, well, almost like a watershed moment, and that we shouldn't really be doing this, but they just kept on doing it anyway. You know, as you mentioned, in Brazil, they kept on doing it, and you look at the stadiums being built in Qatar now. Ain't changing, kid. It ain't changing.
It's not. And like I say, you'd like to think that, you know, that these things will change, and that, you know, eventually lessons will be learned. But I, like you say, without being too cynical, FIFA, for the good of the game, I'm just not sure whose game, but it's for the good of, but that's a whole different issue, yeah. You know, Stephen, you know, and again, another point that sort of, that Devon touched on, and that's the sort of, you know, on the pitch, the performance of South Korea. You know, South Korea have been at World Cups, have been a regular fixture in World Cups, you know, since sort of 86. But it's, you know, you always, normally in World Cups, you know, something we talked about relatively recent, actually, you know, very few international sides have actually won a World Cup. When all is said and done, it's usually ultimately the sort of the powerhouses that will win the tournament. But yet, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, some of the lesser nations to come through. You know, Turkey do it in 2002, South Korea do it, Croatia got to the final at the last World Cup, and especially when it's a co-host as well, it's so good for the tournament to have that sustained involvement, and that almost, you know, can they, you know, I always think back to Ghana and Luis Suarez, and, you know, what could have been for African football, you know, there. And it's, you know, you ultimately, like I say, that it's always the powerhouses that win, but that almost subplot, that side story of, you know, which nation can go the furthest, which nation can upset, you know, and South Korea, you know, getting to the semi-finals sort of pre-tournament was almost unthinkable. And yet, as it built, you know, Devon touches on it, the support, it just seemed to build and build and build as the tournament progressed.
It's absolutely vital to a tournament that the hosts do well, because you can always pick up on that vibe of a tournament. You know, the home support will be absolutely massively enthusiastic for the whole tournament, all of the teams, as long as their team is still part of the party. You know, you can even look at the USA making the last 16 in 94. They gave Brazil a run for the money. So yes, it is massively vital. I think the 2010 World Cup started to fall flat after South Africa were knocked out. You know, they weren't there going into the knockout stages. But South Korea 2002 and Japan to a lesser extent, because they also made the last 16. You know, it was them that made that tournament, rather than the big guns. You know, yes, Brazil won it. Yes, they had Ronaldo in the side. Ronaldinho was there, I think. And it was a huge, huge, huge thing. But at the same time, you know, the story was all about it was all about South Korea, South Korea's party. When it came down to it, and that it's almost like a lifeblood to yes, the big names will eventually win out, but you know, football's nothing without hope, and you know, it's that sense of you know, anything is possible here, or you know, it's breaking those, if not everything is possible, then you know, it's breaking the next ceiling along. You know, so we'd had it with Africa where Cameroon made the 1990 quarterfinals. And we've yet to see an African side go beyond that. But we've had some really close calls. And yes, Ghana, you know, they sprang to mind for me earlier on as well when I was listening along. And it's absolutely vital that, you know, Asian sides, African sides, they have this sense of hope and of aspiration to be able to say, you know, we can go further than we've gone before. And if you go past the quarterfinals and reach the semifinals, then what's your next target? Where is your next ceiling? Your next ceiling is to reach the final. As unlikely as that might sound, once upon a time a semifinal was unlikely. You can point to club football, or, you know, Verona winning Serie A or Leicester winning the Premier League. You know, they are rarities, but there's something massively reassuring that these instances will still happen. No, you know, at least once a generation.
You're right. You know, you're absolutely right. It sort of restores, I suppose, your faith in the game that anything is possible. And that's why people love sport, isn't it? Because anything, you want to believe that anything is possible, however unlikely, any result is in theory achievable. And that's, you know, that's why people play. That's why people play sport. That's why they play the game. Devon, obviously, you know, this, you know, we've touched on, you know, at the beginning, you know, we touched on the side, we touched on Ian Porterfield, you know, and your sort of bravery, if you like, to sort of tell this story that was sort of unfolding sort of before your eyes, really, that, you know, as you said, sort of fell into your lap and, you know, you were brave enough to take it on and sort of write this story. But, you know, for people who are listening, maybe not, you know, not read the book yet, not got the book yet, or hopefully now are starting to think about definitely wanting the book, you know, a little bit really about sort of that journey, that experience, as you sort of, you know, you really get inside of South Korean club football.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I'll give you a sampling of some of the experiences that I had, as you said, when I was following Busan Icons for that 2003 season. And in particular, maybe how it differentiates itself from what people would expect in the UK or whatnot as the experience of a football supporter or a football fan. So one of the first things that really shocked me when I went to a game was that nobody was drinking. Alcohol was banned. And to clarify, you're allowed to drink alcohol at the K-League games. And in fact, there's just copious amounts of alcohol. They're selling tins for 50p. You can buy hard alcohol. You can bring your own alcohol. It's kind of just a free-for-all with alcohol. But in particular, the Busan supporters did not allow alcohol at all. And so both of those aspects were quite bizarre to me, that you could just drink with no regulations in terms of being the average fan. But if you were a hardcore Busan supporter, you had to be completely free of alcohol. It was not to touch your lips or tongue during the day of the games. That was a bit unique for Busan. And the reason for that was there was a bench clearing brawl between Busan and the Suwon players, which actually both sets of supporters joined. They invaded the pitch and apparently there were punches thrown. Some of the supporters struck the players. And when they were thinking about, okay, why did this happen? How do we prevent this from happening again? The Busan supporters realized that both sets of supporters were just absolutely hammered. So Busan decided to go clean, so to speak, and not drink anything on match days, which was quite odd considering that South Korea has one of the biggest drinking cultures anywhere in the world. Like you think of maybe somewhere like Russia where they like their vodka. But if you look at the statistics, Koreans drink more than twice as much alcohol as the Russians do. And it's easily plentifully supplied at the games. And yet, you know, none of the Busan supporters are drinking. So that was quite a bizarre contrast, you know, compared to the UK where you can drink, but not within the sight of the pitch, unless you're way down in non-league or something like that. So that was quite bizarre. There was more of a continental or South American type of support. So you would have a capo, someone who's leading the chants. Usually they have their back turned to the game and they're just, you know, a conductor letting the supporters know what to chant. You have a megaphone in one hand. There's a bunch of drummers. Some people in the UK might not care for that kind of support, but it's definitely passionate, that sort of organized support rather than a spontaneous support. And in addition to large TIFO displays, there would also be pyro. So there would be flares, there would be smoke bombs, things like that. I don't think they have that anymore, unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, coming from depending on where you're coming from. But what was interesting is that I think it was Gary who talked about the military team briefly. All or the vast majority of males in South Korea have to do mandatory national military service for about 18 to 21 months, depending on what you're doing. So almost all men go into the military, and the military has flares. So the flares in the military had this strange way of disappearing and strange way of just appearing at the football grounds, or at least back then. So Busan didn't use them quite so much, but there were some teams that would light, you know, a dozen flares every single game. And that's a huge contrast, obviously, to what we see in the UK or in Canada, USA for the football culture. The away matches were interesting. South Korea is about the same size as England, roughly. So the farthest away trip is only about 5 hours on the coach. It's not too bad compared to, you know, Italy or Japan or something like that. But to a certain degree, the coaches were almost like torture chariots, because there were no washrooms, there were no toilets on the bus. So you'd get on and people would be happy. I suppose in Busan's case, they weren't really drinking alcohol, but I'm trying to think of how the other teams did it, how the other team supporters did it. They would get on the bus and just get absolutely hammered, but there were no toilets. So they must have had to stop at every single motorway rest stop in the entire country to be able to not have their bladders burst. But it was amazing, because for about, I don't know what it would cost, maybe like $7, you would get a round trip coach and a match day ticket. It was just incredibly cheap. And I think they were subsidized by the club to try and get as many people out as possible. But it was a lot of fun. And when we were at particularly arduous derby games, sometimes the supporters would actually hire a goon, a big bodyguard in a dark suit and sunglasses, to get on the bus with us and escort us in and out of the ground. The team that's won the most titles recently, the Jeonbuk Hyundai Motors, back in the early 2000s, they had a reputation for a bit of argy-bargy. So whenever any southern clubs went to their ground, usually they'd have some hired muscle to ensure negative things didn't go down, shall we say. There was a bit of a hooliganism surge in the early 2000s. There's none of that now, essentially, but there was all sorts of stuff going on back then. It was kind of a wild time in K-League history. And one time I mentioned not being able to drink as a Busan supporter, but there was one funny time where I entered the stadium and a employee made a beeline straight to me, and he said, "No drinking, no alcohol," and he left. And he singled me out in particular. I thought, this is kind of strange. So I looked around and there were other people around, but he was only talking to me. So I was the only Western person, and it eventually clicked that he held the belief, I suppose, that as a Westerner, you know, I was a 1970s Millwall supporter or Leeds supporter or something like that. And I wanted nothing more than to punch someone's face in. So it was kind of an odd one. And that links to actually the architectural designs of the stadiums. When Japan and South Korea won the rights to co-host the 2002 World Cup, they were happy, they were celebrating, but then they became kind of fearful, because their stereotype of football was just these, you know, Millwall hooligans rampaging and smashing, not only in the stadium, but outside the stadium too. So I remember in Japan, there were companies, insurance companies, that were offering hooligan insurance because the English national team and their supporters were coming to Japan. So a lot of the shops near the stadiums were boarded up, which was completely unnecessary. And they were buying hooliganism insurance in case the England supporters were to smash up their shops. But nothing like that happened. English fans were having great fun out there. It was all very respectful and polite. But it reminded me of that when this one fellow kind of pulled me over randomly. What else could I talk about? The food in South Korea was really interesting. There's a real dynamic street food culture, and that would go into the stadium. So the name of my book is Who Ate All the Squid? That's a pun, of course, on the old football chant, Who Ate All the Pies? But the reason for it is that one of the most popular snack foods in the stadium was dried squid. So you could buy it in the grocery stores. It would usually be quite hard. People would put it on their stove burner and heat it up so that it would become soft. But somehow they made a soft version of the squid that was sold in the stadiums. And you'd usually dip it either in hot sauce or kind of a sweet mayonnaise. But there was also a food called a bundegi, and it's actually a silkworm pupae. And that might not sound all that appetizing, but it was delicious. It was absolutely delicious. So they would take the silkworm pupae and they would cook it in a sweet soy sauce. And I suspect they snuck a little bit of beef broth in there as well, but it was just magnificent. So they would take a paper cup, fill it with this silkworm pupae. They give you a wooden toothpick to use as a skewer, and you just eat it like a street food, but you could get that at the stadium. Pohang was a bit of a food city, so they had several interesting dishes like bundegi, the silkworm pupae, in their stadium. So that's how I got acquainted with some of the more interesting local foods in South Korea. In terms of on pitch, I mentioned briefly that the older players would demand possession of the ball, or it was expected that they would get the ball. And because of the Confucian order that you show deference to the older players. And actually at Busan, they, during that 2003 season I was there, they brought in an elder player who had been battling injury. And he became the captain just because of his age, not necessarily because he was the best player, although he was pretty good. And some of the players would kind of take the mickey out of him behind his back, and they would call him the customs service, because every time he was on the pitch, he would expect to get the ball. And if he didn't get the ball, he'd throw an absolute strop on the pitch, and everyone in the stadium could see it. So it kind of reminded me, it kind of emphasized the different culture that they use, that the Confucianism even permeates the on-field play in South Korea. One thing that happened then that I don't think happens now is that supporters were actually asked by their club to put graffiti on the team bus. So the club would buy two buses, I'd say, for the actual players to go from, you know, stadium to stadium on a match day. And rather than just keeping the bus generic, or I guess like they do now, they kind of wrap it in a customized club wrap. They would actually just ask the supporters to write, you know, messages of support on the bus. So the supporters buses, or the team buses were just absolutely covered with graffiti. You almost never saw graffiti in South Korea. They just completely stuck out. It was quite odd. I think I mentioned Pohang. When you went to games away at Pohang, they would have hundreds of soldiers at the game because, as I mentioned, all men essentially must do somewhere between 18 and 21 months of mandatory military service. And they had a military barracks near the ground in Pohang. So I think as a kind of a weekend treat for the soldiers, they would all get to go out to the match. And so you'd go on the ground, maybe if you were with the supporters, you'd get there really early, like 2 or 3 hours ahead of time. There would already be almost like an eighth of the ground packed just with military guys wearing camo, green camo trousers, and then a red shirt with their local barrack stamped on it. And they would sit there quietly and they were polite, but then suddenly they would stand up maybe half an hour before kickoff and they would start sprinting around the top of the ground, and they were ordered by their commander to do, you know, 20 laps, something like that. And you would see these soldiers, hundreds of soldiers just sprinting around in a circle, and you'd be wondering, oh no, what's going on? Is North Korea invading? Should I get out of here? And it was just a bit of light exercise for the lads, I guess you could say. And it was quite odd. And then when they were allowed to kind of be more or be less formal when the game started, you'd see, you know, the camera would go on the one of the military lads and they'd show him on the big screen. And then, of course, he'd lift up his shirt and flash his nipples. And it was all quite, you know, informal. But it was quite bizarre. You would never see something like that in a Western country. There was a goalkeeper named Iyongbal, and he had a interest in headwear. So he would usually wear ball caps, and that's not that unusual, but he would graduate from ball caps to wearing bandanas. He would wear cowboy hats, and then near the end of his career, he would actually wear formal top hats. It's just really bizarre, but it was his way of standing out, I guess. I guess players wear their colorful boots these days. So I guess for him, it was the headwear to help him to stand out. There was one incident I went to where Porterfield was struggling a bit at the beginning of the season and the fans were demanding answers. So there was a bit of a confrontational meeting or a showdown between Porterfield and the supporters. And there were actually no members of the media there. So that was an event that I got to attend as a Busan supporter. And there's a whole chapter of my book that's dedicated to that eventful meeting, shall we say. That was one of the interesting experiences that I had. Players could not understand Porterfield and Drew Jarvie. He was the coach, the assistant to Ian Porterfield. Players could not understand their Scottish accents. So they had a professional translator, English-Korean translator. And most of the players could understand English football terms and expressions. So if you had someone with a fairly neutral accent, the players could understand the English football terminology. But Porterfield and Jarvie would go into their, I think, Central Scots accents, and the players, even the professional translator, didn't have a clue what they were saying. So the players would just nod politely. You know, they didn't want to be disrespectful. So, you know, Porterfield or Jarvie would go into this long spiel. We need to do this. We need to change the formation. You need to run faster. You need to attack. The players didn't have a clue what was being said for the first few months, but they would nod very politely and say, okay, okay, okay. So I think it took a while for Porterfield to get into the heads of how to change some of the tactics if they weren't inside, you know, using the tactical board. It's a bit of a stereotype, but I guess it's true. At the end of the games, the fans would often clean up for themselves or around themselves. If they threw any, you know, garbage on the ground, they would pick it up at the end of the game. And in fact, even on the big screen in the stadiums at the end of the game, it would say now's the time to pick up your garbage, that sort of thing. You'd never see that in the Western world, I don't think. I've never seen that in Canada or in the UK. So it was kind of interesting, that idea that you should be responsible for yourself. They do have stadium employees to come around and clean everything up, but you know, essentially you're expected to clean up your own mess. So that was kind of interesting. Stadium washrooms, that was fascinating. So traditionally in South Korea, you would have squat toilets. And that might sound a bit, you know, hokey for us, but actually it's quite good for your body. We should probably be using squat toilets today. But when I got there in 2003, they were mostly gone. They would have relatively modern toilets. But the issue is that the plumbing, the pipes were quite thin. So there was a real fear in South Korea with these new toilets, modern toilets, that you can't flush toilet paper because they'll clog the pipes and then everything will back up and it'll make a mess and you'll be embarrassed and everyone will lose face. And so what they usually did with the Western style toilets is they would have a bin beside the toilet where they put their used toilet paper. So when they built the 2003 Gwangju World Cup Stadium, they had modern plumbing with wide pipes that could handle toilet paper. But because Koreans were so hesitant to put the paper in the toilet, they wanted to put the toilet paper in a bin, but there was no bin because they had, you know, these were nice toilets with thick pipes. So people were horrified. What do I do? I can't flush the toilet paper because it's going to cause a leak or a backup or plumbing issue, but there's no bin to put the paper. So people would scrunch their paper up and just throw it in a corner at this the Gwangju World Cup Stadium that was eventually renamed the Goose Hiddink Stadium. I guess they failed to put up a sign saying it's okay to flush the paper. So I went to a away game there, I think it was in July, and it gets pretty hot in South Korea, especially in the south. So you can imagine a mound of used toilet paper sitting in the corner of the bathroom, and it's this July heat that's just baking it, and it was a it was an interesting cultural experience, shall we say. But I think once they put the sign up, everything was okay afterwards. And I mentioned fans drinking. Like you could bring in anything you wanted. If you wanted to bring in a bottle of vodka, you know, knock yourself silly. There would be some guys, the big drink out there, the ethanol drink of choice is called soju. It's this clear liquid, kind of like vodka, I guess you could say. It's a really popular drink out there. Some guys would bring a shopping bag just packed full of these little soju bottles and just drink them all, get absolutely hammered, get really aggressive, start threatening the stadium security, knowing that because of Korean laws, the security couldn't actually drag them out unless things got really bad. So they would start, you know, taunting the security, these huge goons wearing, you know, black suits, like, come on, let's have a go. Eventually they get bored and either they'd fall asleep or they'd start chucking some of their bottles on the field, stuff like that. And that's a very small minority of people, but it was a real eye-opener that alcohol was just so tolerated at in South Korean football. When I was out there, there was also a super typhoon. Never seen anything like it. So in East Asia, they have typhoons. Some countries in particular get hit harder than others. South Korea is probably one of the hardest hit. They get typhoons every single summer, sometimes multiple typhoons. But the year I was there, there was a Category 5 typhoon, which is the highest scale in the category scale. So that absolutely hammered west of Busan. Luckily, it didn't hit Busan too much directly, but I think there was about 5,000 homes that were destroyed. I was living in an apartment building and you could feel it swaying. I thought there was, at first I thought there was thunder. Then I thought my neighbors were moving their furniture above me, but it turned out to be just the wind, basically. It was so strong and the whole building was swaying. And all the players, these English players who I mentioned, were out there during this time. So that would have been a real eye-opener to them, being used to the kind of temperate, calm, drizzly UK culture. Some other oddities that I'll mention that weren't necessarily direct experiences, but were things that happened during that year that I thought I would mention. Ian Porterfield tried to sign a Ghanaian striker named Michael Osei. So previous to working in Korea, Porterfield worked in Ghana, and Michael Osei was his best player, the striker who scored really well. So he tried to sign Michael Osei and bring him in. Unfortunately, the agent lied about Michael Osei's status. So when Busan inquired, is this player free at the end of the season? Does his contract end? His agent, who's a lawyer, said, yes, he's free. Turns out he wasn't free. So Busan signed this player, paid a transfer to the player's agent. Then the club, the Ghanaian club of this Ghanaian player, found out, complained to FIFA about Busan tampering with their players. It became this political storm. Busan weren't able to get this player in the end. And then Busan ordered the agent to pay them back, but the agent basically disappeared from what I hear. So the player was actually banned from playing by FIFA until this money was paid back. I think the subsequent Ghanaian club he signed for paid back Busan. It was just this real absolute mess. And just really quickly, Gary mentioned the military team. The city of Gwangju built a World Cup stadium. So after the World Cup, they needed to have a team. You know, they didn't want an empty World Cup stadium. So they tried to arrange or establish clubs in all of these cities with World Cup stadiums. So they put the military team in Gwangju, but arguably that was the absolute worst fit because I mentioned earlier there were democracy protests in the late 70s and the early 80s. And Gwangju was really the center of those protests. And there was a really bloody crackdown of the regime against the young lads going out to get a democracy going. So in that southwest corner in Gwangju, they just absolutely hate the military. They hate the national government. So the K-League decided to put the military team there. Of course, where else would you put it? So football supporters in the city of Gwangju, they're in this real predicament. They despise the military, but finally they get a professional football team, but it's the military football team. So what do? Do they support it or do they boycott and ignore it? In the end, they decided to support the team, kind of just ignoring the military aspect and treating it like a local club. But the supporters named themselves as a group. They named themselves 1980, which was an explicit reference to the bloody crackdown that happened. There was all sorts of odd things going on. Like there was a subway fire in late 2002 in the city of Daegu. And 8 days after the fire, Daegu announced they had a new logo for the club, and it was a swirling flame. So it was an odd choice, shall we say. And there were footballers. Gary talked about the military team and that you could play football for the military team in order to satisfy your requirements. So you didn't actually have to pick up guns and go jumping out of helicopters. There were players who they weren't good enough essentially to play for the military team, but they wanted to avoid the military draft. So there was this scandal in around 2003, 2004, where players were intentionally dislocating their shoulders so they could avoid having to go and play had to go and fulfill military service. So it was an interesting time. You know, like there were club owners, like there was a cult leader who was imprisoned in the USA and was banned from entering Germany. They refused to give him a visa. He was the owner of the champions then, Seongnam. Earlier, the Korean CIA had created a club because the 1966 England World Cup, North Korea did quite well. They beat Italy. That actually inspired South Korea to try and put together a strong team. There was no league back then. So essentially, all the best players were gathered up and they were playing for this single Korean CIA team. Didn't last very long, but it was kind of an interesting dot in Korean football history. But I guess I'll leave it there. There were quite a few interesting experiences that I had directly, but also as I was writing the book and researching, there was a lot of interesting stories and interesting tales to tell. And I hope I peppered enough of them into the book to satisfy the reader.
I mean, like I say, from when this book sort of came out or became aware of it via sort of social media, and like, you know, I know we keep going back to the title and you sort of explained there where that title comes from, but you know, straight away it was one of those books where it's like, it just sort of stayed on the radar and it stayed on the public conscience till we were sort of able to get a copy. You know, Gary, like we said, there's so much there to sort of take in, and you know, like we said right at the beginning, you know, it was a brave decision to pick a subject that is not necessarily non-traditional, because you know, as we've discussed, football translates right across all countries and cultures. But you know, to be able to have the bravery to turn it into, you know, a book and be able to tell the story and do the story justice and do it in a way that sort of engages the reader and makes you want to learn more is always, I guess, isn't it, the sign of a good book?
Yeah, it is. And you know, just sort of hearing Devon just sort of go through those reminiscences as he was of Korea, it just shows what a sort of, you know, for a European football fan, how alien it all sounds. And the book is very much like that. And it's an introduction to a world of football that perhaps very few people who watch European football, be it the UK or in Europe, would have much perception of. And you know, As a travel guide is not the right word, but as an introduction to another type of football, it's a great book for that. And you know, and as I say, you know, that makes it even more of a brave way of brave decision to go out and make the experience into a book, and then pursue the publication and great reward to have that book out there now.
It is. I mean, and like I say, there's clearly a market for this. You know, and like we say, perhaps it's ignorance. Certainly, on my part, I'm quite happy to hold my hands up. And you know, I think Stephen's mentioned this, sort of the term skepticism, and I'm probably one of the worst ones until I've looked at it, watched it, you know, sort of read about it, and then, you know, more willing to sort of accept it. But I guess, you know, Stephen, you know, as we just said there, football is football, and it will always translate across. And yes, things might appear different, sound slightly different. There might be different traditions that go with it, but ultimately the game will always engender the same passion, the same dedication amongst it, certainly amongst the hardcore fans. It will, you know, a lot of football's popularity is down to the simplicity of the game. It's an incredibly simple game, and yet it's a game that does translate across continents, across languages, across cultures. And I think true football fans really probably will embrace it. And certainly you would hope that they would embrace football culture from, you know, like we said right at the beginning, from some of the less well-known geographical areas.
Oh, completely. The more that you absorb football in all sorts of different environments, the more you see the similarities rather than the differences. That's the thing that strikes me, is that, you know, it isn't what divides, it's what binds, you know, and it is, you know, so much that is familiar. You know, when you wind up in an unfamiliar environment with a familiar concept, you know, it really is very, very striking in that respect. And Devin's book's brilliant in putting that across. And, you know, earlier on as well, he mentioned two books, Tim Park's Season in Verona and Joe McGinnis with The Miracle of Castel de Sangro. And those are the books that, you know, I was intimating to, that it had that theme running through it. There's almost a kind of effect where it's, man with a briefcase, man in a Panama hat. You know, it's someone who's out there. You know, there's such the Alan Wicker about it. You know, there's someone who's out there with an American Express card, and, you know, completely off the beaten track that they're expected to be in, finding these things that are just utterly striking and, you know, brilliantly familiar. But, never give in to your skepticism, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, because there is so much there that wherever football is, the building blocks of it are the same wherever you find it.
It absolutely is. Before we go, like I say, we're well over the hour, which is fine. You know, we've no problem with that. But I have got one more question for all three of you. But it is a one word, one or maybe two word answer. That's it. So you can't choose your own clubs, Gary and Stephen, you can't choose your own clubs. But, you know, as we've talked about there, the genre of the book, and, you know, and Devin mentioned it right at the beginning, this following a club genre. Present day, you can pick any club to follow for a season and write a book on. Who are you picking? I'm going to throw it to you first, Gary. I'm really sorry. You've had the least amount of thinking time. But if you had to write one of these sort of, you know, fully immerse yourself in a club genre, you know, we you can't pick Chelsea, but other than that, which club, you can go anywhere in the world, which club are you picking?
Can I be a bit cheeky and say,
two? I'm thinking of two.
Club Deportivo Retama.
Okay.
You got that?
Yeah, you've got a reason?
Well, that's because it's a club in my book.
Okay, brilliant. There you go, see.
Well, they don't really exist, but you know.
I'm still waiting to find out what happens, by the way.
There's time yet, Matt.
Good. Because he can't go back to... Well, I won't say it. I'm going to give it away then. I won't say it. Don't worry. Stephen, for you?
For me, someone like... Rayo Vallecano or a Livorno, something like that. Some you know, a left-leaning, politically leading football club. I'll go with a Livorno, something like that.
Brilliant. And, I mean, obviously, Devin, you've done it, but if you had to go through it all again, which club would you pick?
That's a good question. I've become rather smitten with supporter-owned clubs. In some countries, they're quite common, like in Germany, Sweden, Turkey. But obviously, in places like the UK, they're quite unique. There have been quite a few clubs in the... Sorry, this is supposed to be a two-word answer, isn't it? Beg your pardon. So anyway, really quickly, there have been quite a few big clubs, relatively big clubs in the UK that were supporter owned, but no longer are, like Wrexham and Portsmouth and Wickham's down to just 25%. But I think AFC Wimbledon is one of those clubs that's really stood out because the fan ownership is part of their DNA. There have been some books about Wimbledon, but I think a really thick tome about AFC Wimbledon's entire journey and what's likely to happen in the future would be really interesting.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent answers. Guys, you know, it's been brilliant. Devon, you know, thank you so much for coming on. And certainly for me, you know, via the book and obviously via tonight, sort of enlightening myself, you know, and the listeners about, you know, about football in a relatively unknown part of the world. You know, it's been brilliant to listen to you.
Well, thanks very much for having me on, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity. As you said, it's a part of the world where we don't see very much about football. Korea has become quite popular in terms of K-pop and dramas and things like that, but the football remains relatively obscure. So I hope this story can help introduce Korean football to the readers.
Absolutely. Like we said, you know, it's Hue All the Squid. It's a, you know, it's a play on the sort of the popular English chant. It, you know, even the title will stick with you. Once you've listened to this podcast, you're not going to have to write the title down. Gary, enjoyed it?
Yeah, I mean, it can't beat a good football book. And this is a good football book, but it's also very educational as well. Tells us about a culture of football that I knew very little about. And I won't say I know a stat about it now, but I certainly know a lot more thanks to Devon's book. So yeah, great hour or so chat.
And obviously, you know, Stephen, like we say, I can only speak for you. I'm not speaking for you in any way, but certainly, like you say, a very much a traditionalist. It's, you know, your environment where you first fall in love with the game, and you know, it seems such an alien concept, and yet when you read about it and listen to it, it makes perfect sense.
It does. That's the thing. You know, there's a scene in Indiana Jones, I think it's The Last Crusade, that springs to mind, where Marcus tips up and is it where Indy turns around and says he can blend in absolutely anywhere. And it'll be 3 days ahead of you already. And there he is at the train station trying to flag someone down that speaks English. You know, this is how I see us. But having our eyes, you know, open, and it's absolutely spectacular. Absolutely loved it.
Brilliant. Guys, like I say, you know, thank you ever so much. All that's left is for me to say is to thank everyone for listening. And please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.